So the first reading on page 150, Deuteronomy 5, verses 1 to 22. And Moses summoned all Israel and said to them, "Hear, O Israel, the statutes and the rules that I speak in your hearing today, and you shall learn them and be careful to do them. The Lord our God made a covenant with us in Horeb. Not with our fathers did the Lord make this covenant, but with us, who are all of us here alive today. The Lord spoke with you face to face at the mountain, out of the midst of the fire, while I stood between the Lord and you at that time, to declare to you the word of the Lord. For you were afraid because of the fire, and you did not go up into the mountain. He said, 'I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is on the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Observe the Sabbath day to keep it holy as the Lord your God commanded you. For 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter or your male servant or your female servant or your ox or your donkey or any of your livestock or the sojourner who is within your gates, that your male servant and your female servant may rest as well as you. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out from there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day. Honor your father and your mother as the Lord your God commanded you, that your days may be long and that it may go well with you in the land that the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, and you shall not desire your neighbor's house, his field, or his male servant, or his female servant, his ox, or his donkey, or anything that is your neighbor's. These words the Lord spoke to all your assembly at the mountain, out of the midst of the fire, the cloud, and the thick darkness with a loud voice, and he added no more. And he wrote them on 2 tablets of stone and gave them to me." Then over a few pages to page 973, Galatians 3, starting at verse 15. To give a human example, brothers, even with a man-made covenant, no one annuls it or adds to it once it has been ratified. Now the promises were made to Abraham and to his offspring. It does not say, "and to offsprings," referring to many, but referring to one, "and to your offspring, who is Christ." This is what I mean. The law, which came 430 years afterwards, does not annul a covenant previously ratified by God, so as to make the promise void. For if the inheritance comes by the law, it no longer comes by promise, but God gave it to Abraham by a promise. Why then the law? It was added because of transgressions, until the offspring should come, to whom the promise had been made, and it was put in place through angels by an intermediary. Now an intermediary implies more than one, but God is one. Is the law then contrary to the promises of God? Certainly not, for if a law had been given that could give life, then righteousness would indeed be by the law. But the scripture imprisoned everything under sin, so that the promise by faith in Jesus Christ might be given to those who believe. And I'll pray as we start. Then I will ever bless your name with songs of joy and praise, and I'll fulfill my holy vows to you throughout my days. Father, we ask as we look at your word now. You would help us to fulfill our obligations to you in all of our life. And we ask that in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, I wonder if Christians often approach the Bible in a similar way to how they watch the Toy Story films. For those of you not familiar with the modern classic, apparently one of the biggest grossing trilogies ever made, is it's about toys who belong to a little boy called Andy and who come to life when he leaves the room. And each film has a similar pattern. Something goes wrong, the other toys try to help. There are misunderstandings, more things go wrong as a direct result of them trying to help, and much mess and hilarity, and it all ends up happily ever after. Now, I think that's how most Christians view the Bible, isn't it? That God created a perfect world, people messed it up, and so he has to make a promise to put that right to Abraham. But then his descendants get it all wrong again, and he has to rescue Israel through Moses. And then he gave Moses the law, but then people broke it, and he sent the prophets, but people ignored them. And in a final act of desperation, he sent Jesus, and it all ends happily ever after, we think. In some ways, that's understandable, because that's kind of things, apparently, from a human point of view, go wrong as you go through the Bible. And the New Testament can at times seem quite negative about the Old Testament, especially the place of the law, whilst other times, though, it seems very positive. So why is it that Jesus and New Testament writers keep using Old Testament examples approvingly and remind us of Old Testament teaching? And talk about the law and keeping it. And then talk about the letter killing and the needing to be freed from the law in the next bit. So what we've been doing this term is we're looking at how God relates to his people through a covenant. So a bit different to what we normally do. We're looking at sort of big themes. So we've seen this theme of covenant traces through the Bible. So there's a covenant that God the Father made with God the Son, which gets called a covenant of redemption. It assures us that God will save a people, and that was his plan in eternity. We saw God make a covenant with humanity through Adam, which was broken and is broken. And then last week we saw this covenant with Abraham, which is called the covenant of grace, which works itself out through to the church of today and us here. And between Adam and Abraham, we saw a covenant with Noah that kind of bridges that gap between God's intentions in creation and redemption. But in that covenant of grace, there are phases of that plan. We thought about this phrase before, of these sort of software upgrades, only unlike ones today, software upgrades that work. So one which is this one we've got here, the law and God's covenant with Moses that he made at Sinai. So that reading in Deuteronomy is them looking back on when God gave them the law in Exodus. And the second reading helps us understand how it fits together. And we haven't got time to say everything you might have been thinking as I was reading it. There's a lot here. We're not going to go through everything that I've read. And I'm not pretending to, and we're going to avoid a whole load of complexity and controversy as well. And you can go into this in a lot more depth in your own time. But first we're going to look at that passage from Galatians. We looked at Galatians a while ago, and we saw about, in it, it has about how God fulfilled his plan in Jesus, and so we have a changed relationship to the law. So if you look at verses 15 to 18, Paul points out that the promise comes before the law was given. Simply in history, Abraham comes before Moses. God made a promise to Abraham that he would father a nation before the law is given. And we notice when I read the law at the start, it says, I am the Lord your God. This is the same in both Deuteronomy and Exodus versions of the Ten Commandments. I am the Lord your God who took you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Then he says, you shall not, and the Ten Commandments. In other words, as I've often said, something like this, verse 6 comes before verse 7 onwards. So the law doesn't abolish or replace the promise. That's to say, there are not two ways to be saved, by trusting in the promise or obeying the law. The other thing to notice is that the law has a purpose to it in verses 19 to 20, and it's to do with sin. We will look at its purpose a bit more a bit later on. But in Galatians, Paul talks about the law as our schoolmaster or our teacher, In Romans, it's there to highlight the problem of sin. And notice here there's a need for a mediator, a go-between, because of this legal system. So law is not opposed to promise. It's a part of the plan, rather than in competition to each other. And we saw before, didn't we, in Hebrews, God's big plan gets called an eternal covenant. But three times in the New Testament, Paul refers to covenants in the plural. So the best way to understand the law, which is that it forms part of the covenant with Moses, is like this. There is one overall plan. It works out in one covenant of grace. But the detail is worked out in distinct covenants within it. So it's that software upgrades idea. You know, you get one bit of software, it doesn't fundamentally change, but they keep on upgrading it, supposedly improving it. So let's look at a bit at this covenant itself. If you flip back to Deuteronomy 5 on page 150, and you probably recognised it straight away as the Ten Commandments, but here Moses calls it the covenant. Notice a few things about it. First, obvious thing, it's given by God. It's given by God, though, to the people through one man, beginning of verse 1, verses 4 to 5, verse 22. It's given to Moses to pass on. And that's been a reoccurring theme through this series, hasn't it? That God makes a covenant with many people through one man as the representative of many others, as a figurehead. Another name for covenant is federal. So Germany and the USA have federal governments. That means their states are joined together by a covenant, or as we call it, a federation. And sometimes we talk of God's covenants being made with a federal head. In this case, it's Moses. It's most often used of Adam. He's called the federal head of humanity. So Moses is made with Moses, and Moses' job is to pass it on, second half of verse 1, so that they hear and do it. And in verses 2 and 3, the Ten Commandments are called a covenant. Notice, this is about the covenant, it's called the covenant. And notice they're written on, at the end of the reading, it said, two stone tablets. Now, pause for a second, think about what we've said over the last few weeks. We've said that some of these biblical covenants are very similar to the covenants and international treaties that countries made at the time the Bible was written. So what you'd have is you'd have a big king covenanting with a small king on the behalf of that small king's people. So covenants were then written out twice, once for each king, and the copies were taken and put in the temple of each king's god. So if you think about how most contracts are made today, often they're done on that sort of copy paper, aren't they? They've been done in duplicate or triplicate, and you have copies of the contract. I have a contract with this church, with the corporate body that is this church. So it was written out twice. I signed it. One of the trustees signed it twice. And then there's a copy in the CPC filing cabinet. There's a copy in my filing cabinet. And both parties have agreed to do certain things for the other. So that's how a covenant used to work. So the two kings would make these covenants with each other. So often it's assumed, and when you see it in artwork, the Ten Commandments are written in two halves, as if God doesn't have very small handwriting. So he has it in two halves to fit it all in. So you have, normally it has 1 to 4, sometimes 1 to 5, and then 5 to 10 on the other. That's what the text says. It just says they're two tablets. And it reads more naturally and fits with how things work that you have two full-length copies, God's copy and Israel's copy. And they both go into the ark. We'll think about that a bit later. So there's, and all these, just like you do in a contract, just like you did in these covenants, in these international treaties, they start with a preamble. And that's just what you get in Deuteronomy 5. So first the covenant, conquering king would say how great it is that you've been conquered by him, because he's such a wonderful king. You're very lucky that you've been conquered by him and not by another tyrant. And look at all the things that he's done for you in conquering you. And then would come the conditions that you need to keep. So that's what you get then in verse 6. And what the king, sorry, verse 6, what the king has done, and then verse 7 onwards, the conditions that you need to keep. And notice it's grace before works again. God saves his people, then he tells them how to live. He doesn't say, behave like this to be mine. He doesn't say, behave like this, and then I'll save you from Egypt. He doesn't give them the Ten Commandments in Egypt, he gives them at Horeb or Sinai. In other words, verse 6 comes before verse 7. Grace comes before law. Abraham came before Moses. But, to go a bit further on, in verse 32, he says, you shall be careful, therefore, to do as the Lord your God has commanded you. You shall not turn aside to the right or to the left. So he says, obedience does lead to blessing. So, the Ten Commandments are the covenant document, but you know what happens next. Moses comes down from the mountain and he finds the golden calf incident and lots of things going wrong. He found the people breaking the covenant. So he throws the tablets down, breaking them. The covenant is broken in every sense. They're remade later, or reproduced later. So God is ready to destroy Israel for their covenant breaking. But what does Moses do? He appeals to God not to destroy Israel. On what basis can he do that? Well, if you read on a few more chapters to Deuteronomy 9, he appeals to them on the basis of his covenant with Abraham, not with what he's done in recent times, but the covenant that goes back those 430 years to Abraham, and that Israel are God's inheritance. So Moses appeals to God on the basis of his big plan. If you then flick over to Deuteronomy 10, the new tablets are made with the Ten Commandments on them, and they're put in the ark. And that seems significant for two reasons. First, who meets the demands? Remember, they would put the two copies in the two different temples, but they both copies go into the ark. The ark is with the people, but it represents God's presence. Ultimately, then, God is making a statement about himself meeting the demands of the covenant. And secondly, sacrifices are put on the mercy seat. So the ark is just a box overlaid in gold, and then they had these two angels on the top with their wings. And so the Ten Commandments are in the box, and then the sacrifice is put over the wings. They come between the covenant and God. So the sacrifice covers the covenant that is being broken. It is covered in blood. Death separates the breaking from the holy God. And also it's mentioned that I've mentioned this before, there tends to be a sign or a sacrament that goes with the covenant. It's not in this passage, but in the end of Exodus 31, I just mentioned this, is that there is a covenant sign where you renew the covenant with God, and that is the Sabbath day. So every Sabbath, every week, God's people renew the covenant on the Sabbath. There's also the leaders go and meet with God on the mountain and eat with him. Towards the end of Deuteronomy, you get this great summary of the covenant, which I'll read to you. It's chapter 30, verses 15 to 18. So it says, see, I have set before you today life and good, death and evil. If you obey the commandments of the Lord your God that I command you today, by loving the Lord your God, by walking in his ways and by keeping his commandments and his statutes and his rules, then you shall live and multiply, and the Lord your God will bless you in the land that you are inheriting, so that you are entering to take possession of it. But if your heart turns away and you will not hear, but are drawn away to worship other gods and serve them, I declare to you today that you shall surely perish. You shall not live long in the land that you are going over to the Jordan to enter and possess. So, God is a God to a specific group of people. They're bound to each other, them to God. And obedience leads to blessing in a land. Disobedience leads to exile and curse. Exile means being removed from the land. Or we could say instead of obedience and disobedience, we could say covenant keeping, covenant breaking. Now that sounds familiar to what we've already looked at, doesn't it? It sounds familiar to Genesis 2:17. Don't eat. If you do, you will die, and you'll have to leave the garden. Implying, if you do, if you obey, you'll live. And when we looked at this, we saw Adam, in breaking that covenant, in breaking that one law, he actually broke all Ten Commandments. I won't go through that again. But the result was the curse. The people were exiled from Eden. They're removed from the land. And same thing happens with this law. So is this like God restating a covenant with Adam? Is he giving us a second chance? And if so, why is he only doing it with Israel? Well, of course, we know what happens next, don't we? The covenant gets broken with increasing seriousness. Israel repeatedly warned by the prophets to keep the covenant. Someone once described the prophets not as foretellers, but as covenant law enforcement officers, saying that's their main job, is to keep the covenant. Israel repeatedly warned, they repeatedly ignore the warnings, they experience all kinds of curses and are ultimately exiled and removed from the promised land. So why does God give the law? Has God done a bodge job here? Now the obvious answer has to be no. And the New Testament says lots about the law and would explain why sometimes it's put so positively and other times so negatively. But the failure of Israel is part of the plan. And the whole plan is to bring us to Christ. Remember, this is part of the covenant of grace. Some people call it a restatement of the covenant of works, but it's not. It's a covenant of grace. It looks a bit like it says something, it gives us something to do, but it is gracious. It is gracious to us, but it is works for Christ. Let me show you why. It's grace for us. Back in Deuteronomy 5, the Ten Commandments, we notice that verse 6 comes before verse 7. The grace comes before law. God says, now you're my people, live like this, not the other way around. He doesn't say, live like this, then you can join my people. We can't expect people who don't belong to God to live as though they do. That's not how you get in. And all the controversies through history about morality in the church are on this point, that we're meant to live it out, not live to get in. God's law does not exclude anyone, but to say, once you're in, this is how you act. And this law is good for everyone. It reveals God's standards and therefore God. But it can't be kept. The people break the law. And we're reminded in the book of James that to break any part of the law is to break all of it. Like Adam, in breaking one law, he breaks them all. When we break one law, we break them all. But in this covenant with Moses is the sacrificial system. God knew that they were weak, that they were fallen, and so he provides a way of dealing with sin. And that was a gracious act of God to the people of the time, and it is gracious to us too, because it teaches us that forgiveness is bought by the spilling of innocent blood, that sin must be transferred, as we're thinking about in the big question with the kids this morning. But under Moses, this was constantly repeated, because the people constantly sin, as did the priests who offered the sacrifices. They sinned too and died. So the Old Testament believers trusted God, that he had graciously called them. In turn, they followed his ways and in repentance went to the priest for sacrifices which covered their covenant breaking. And we will see that actually things aren't that different under the New Testament when we come to the New Covenant in a few weeks. Jesus and the apostles tell us that obedience leads to blessing and that our actions expose our faith as either real or fake. But the Old Testament system was a great burden to the people. It was meant to be. It was really hard for them. The covenant couldn't be kept. You read through the sacrifices, if you read through the book of Leviticus and all the sacrificial system, the thing that strikes your mind is, what a bloody mess, literally, as you're cleansed by the priest sprinkling blood all over you. As they put blood all over the altar, the blood on anything that's being used. And this covenant breaking, as you go through the Old Testament, gets worse and worse. So the covenant with Moses is gracious to us, and in part because it makes the problem absolutely clear. And in the sacrificial system and in the land, it gives us a shadow of something much bigger, which is the solution to the problem. So the law is gracious, revealing something of the gospel, no odds with it. So just like we saw Noah comes between the fall and Abraham as sort of bridging that gap, the law comes between Abraham and Christ to bridge that gap and points a way forward for us. But this covenant is works for Jesus. Galatians 4:4-5 says, but when the time had fully come, God sent his son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those under the law, that we might receive the full rights of sons. So saying Jesus is born of a woman, like all people. He's part of Adam's people, although he's born of a virgin birth. He's not a descendant of Adam in that way. To save all kinds of people. He's born under the law. He's born a Jew. He's born under Moses. Born under the covenant with Moses. And he kept the law fully. So he's entitled to all the blessings of the covenant. But instead, he dies on the cross. So it's just like the exchange we saw this morning with the Yulki bar and the egg. The law of Moses says, cursed is anyone who dies on a tree. And Paul quotes that in Galatians 3:13 to show that Jesus died to take our curse. And we're given his covenant blessings. So the curse for our covenant breaking falls on him, but the blessings of the covenant keeping is freely given to us. Just as Israel's obedience gave them blessing in the promised land, so Jesus' obedience gives us a blessing of the heavenly land. And this is why the covenant with Moses is so gracious to us. As well as teaching us our need and points to the solution, it provides the solution in the one greater than Moses. And like I said, what we're doing this term is a little bit different by not looking at one passage. Some of what we're doing is getting a different way of thinking. So later on in the term, we've got a few more passages to look at to see the covenant. So we'll see some of the application, how it all pans out towards the end of the term. But some things to be getting on with now. There's a few loose ends. If you haven't noticed, I'll keep quiet, but there'll be those loose ends we'll come back to next week and the week after. But why does any of this matter to us? See, often Christians do think, oh, well, that's the Old Testament. It doesn't apply to us now, does it, the Old Testament? Especially not the law. But it is still very relevant to us. If nothing else, it provides the backdrop to understand Jesus. Much of what Jesus does makes little sense unless we're willing to go back to the law. But the law is useful to us. This is going to use very typical Reformed language. There are three uses of the law. The Christian Institute has a very helpful little booklet on this. They're called often the pedagogic, civil, and moral, or normative. So pedagogic just means teaching. So the law teaches us. It reveals God. By revealing his standards, it reveals him, what he is like, and his holiness. The civil use means it can't change our hearts, but it does restrain evil. That's particularly true anywhere where Christianity and Judaism has had any kind of influence, that our laws are based on this, and so it restrains evil. And even within the church, although we can't punish evildoers for things they do, nonetheless, we hold each other to account. It restrains evil. And then the moral and normative use, it guides us. Jesus and the New Testament writers have no qualms about applying the law to us. So the law still does what it always did. Now, there are at times subtle things we need to work out about how bits of the law apply differently today, like food laws and things like that, bits that have been fulfilled and passed as they stood, but it still gives us lots of guidance for a good way to live and reveals God's character to us. Now, we know that some bits are applied differently to us, but they still are relevant to us. And the reason for that is, to use a well, not an illustration, but if you go to parts of North London, you'll see lots of Jews, and they're different sects of Jews, and that you can tell by the way they dress and their clothes. So you see specific shops. I used to go to a church in Hendon, and if you go to Hendon, white people, Chinese people, black people, will refer to themselves as Gentiles, because we were such a small minority compared to the Jews around us. And most of the shops had Hebrew writing up or Yiddish, and they had special food laws, they have special clothes, they have a special hairstyle, sometimes even tie bits of the Torah to their head so that they would stand out. A number of other things that I guess we would consider stranger. And that was the point of the law. If you were trading in the Middle East at the time that we're talking about here in the Old Testament, when you go into the Promised Land, you'd notice that they were different from the nations around them. When they go away out of the land to trade, they look different. That Israel was meant to stand out as God's priests to the nations. So when you go through Hendon or Golders Green, you know when you see a Jew. And you know when you see a Gentile. They look different. They're meant to look different. They're not meant to be the same. In a few weeks, we'll come to how and why those things are different for us. but the same principle stands. It should be obvious to everyone that you are a Christian, that you stick out a mile, not because you've got a bit of the Bible tied to your head or because of your hairstyle or whatever it is, but nonetheless, it should be pretty obvious quite quickly that you are different. It's very popular in churches and for Christians to be the same as the world, to say, we've got to be the same as everyone else, haven't we? As soon as we think that, we have entirely missed the point. So that means, when you put all that together, it means you need to read it. It's hard work at times, but to read the law. The law and the Old Testament are our book. And remember from last week, there is one people of God. The people of Sinai, or Horeb, whatever word you use, the people of Sinai are a part of our church. We are with them. This is our book. There's one covenant mediator because Moses leads us to another, a greater mediator of a greater covenant, Jesus. So be amazed at God's plan, how each phase dovetails together, each book of the Bible, each phase of history, each of these covenants. It's not like a Toy Story comedy. It's planned in detail. But the key here in this part of the covenant is the seriousness of our sin and the freedom we have because of Jesus. Our need to have our covenant breaking covered by the blood of the covenant keeper. The very one who made the terms and conditions that we failed to keep came and kept them and bore the curses for our covenant breaking so we can have his blessings. We need to come to him for forgiveness and also for the blessings of the heavenly land.